Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 239.JE0207, certificate number 54146, the Cocoa Nut Revolution.
You're going to say Cocoa Nut the whole time? That's fine.
How do you say it?
I say it the way Kamala says it.
Oh, how does she say it?
Coconut, it's a schwa.
Oh, coconut.
Do you never say, do you always say coconut, including the shredded thing, the thing in the palm tree, going coconuts with the Osmonds?
I don't. I was just doing it as a bit. You caught me.
This is not about K-Hive. We're recording this at the height of coconut meme mania. Are you not following online Kamala discourse?
No, I have no idea why Kamala. I mean, I understand.
You don't know why she's in the news?
I understand why she's in the news, but I don't know any combination or any like correlation between Kamala and coconuts.
I guess it's an oft-told story she's done in various.
It's one of her bits.
Yeah, it's one of her running bits. And I think it's got a vaguely, I think it's a lesson from her mom that's vaguely Marxist coded.
Oh, I see.
So the young people think it's based to use, they think based Kamala would prefer them to use coconut, palm, and fruit memes and emojis a lot.
That is super based.
But it's a little, what could be more based than the coconut? But it turns out that's...
Yeah. Why are you pointing at me?
Because there's a chance that it's actually extremely unwoke to use coconuts because that's been a slur against Desi people.
Sure.
And I just learned this yesterday. It's the Latino equivalent of like Oreo or Twinkie.
To call someone a coconut. Oh,
brown,
dark on the outside.
Yeah, brown on the outside, white on the inside.
Oh, who knew
that? It's very fraught.
The cocoa nut was so fraught.
When we were kids, it was just the most controversial chocolate in the sampler.
Well, except I hate coconut chocolate, but you could also wear it as a bra. That was something that we saw a lot in sort of mocking Polynesian culture.
Yeah, and also, like maybe that's queer friendly.
Okay.
Because it's always burly South Pacific CBs
right.
with their coconut bras
that's
on.
That's right. Like their true selves are coming out as they're dancing for their fellow sailors.
Maybe Gilligan and the Skipper, mm-hmm. Not having easy access to women the way the millionaire does. Maybe mm-hmm. they are trying on coconut bras when they're alone in each other's.
True. Thurston Howell is the only one actually mated or paired with a female counterpart.
There are two unpaired women. There's Ginger and Marianne.
No, I know. I'm familiar.
I don't need to gill-splain to you. Minnow-splaining. But there's three men.
Three men.
And the professor is...
Ambiguous.
Asexual?
Well, he seems... I mean, he's the sexiest of all the men.
He is by far the best-looking man, but that probably means he's gay-coded, right?
Well, he's sort of like a... I mean, he reads as asexual because he's so consumed with numbers and science.
And building radios out of coconuts.
Yeah, he's a scientist, and as we know, all scientists are gay.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You're not as hip to the scientist.
I have not been following this at all. How long have all scientists been gay?
Since the very beginning.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's Hippocrates.
Yeah, it's, you know, they were born that way.
That's nice.
Mm-hmm. I do feel that coconuts appear, I mean, they're a good way to make a clip-clop sound for a horse, and that is from ye olde England.
Yes. So I don't know how they got them. They must have floated there.
They washed up. They washed up from...
Do you think they were carried by a particular bird? A particular African bird?
Interesting.
Not really.
Nerd!
No, this is going to be set in the South Pacific, like Gilligan's Island possibly is. Mm-hmm. How far could they get in a 3-hour tour?
From Hawaii, not very far. It has to be one of the Hawaiian islands, but we kind of have charted them all.
Do they leave from Hawaii?
Yeah, they leave from Honolulu.
It's got to be that. Well, I mean, the footage I think is like Marina Del Rey or San Diego or something.
I was thinking of Marina Del Rey just this morning.
Weird.
I was like, Marina Del Rey.
What's up with it?
There's no center.
True.
There's no place in Marina Del Rey.
Well, it's because it's a road curving around a marina, and then all the shopping and hotels that have accreted around that.
Yeah, and I've gone up all of those little isthmuses, all the little docks, looking for anything.
Looking for the soul.
Just looking for the soul of Marina Del Rey. I never found anything, and then I realized I've never been to Marina Del Rey in a boat. And maybe boat,
that's the right approach.
When you look at it, As you're motoring in, you're like, ah, I see.
There it is.
Marina Del Rey, I comprehend it. But from the land, it's incomprehensible.
I think it's clear from this that you think a lot about geography and spatial things. You and I are hard to stump on geo stuff, right?
We like that stuff. Do you still play Geo Tagger or Geo Searcher or whatever the hell?
Geo Guesser. The one that plops you down in a Google Street View on some Namibian highway.
Yes. I loved that when it first came out, and I you could not beat me because I was always like, mountain range in the background. Well, that doesn't look like that mountain range. It's got to be the Atlas Mountain.
But have you heard about people who are like, that street sign is green and curved on the lower left. I know which state of Zambia this is, and
yeah, I don't know those people.
I know them online. They're like the guys doing the Rubik's Cube blindfolded. Like, you can't believe the human brain can do what they do. But also, what's the point?
Pretty good from as soon as I see a house, I'm like, right, that's got to be hither or thither, right? It's the house that then makes me contextualize the mountains and the flora.
I need
a
little flowchart. Is it on stilts? Yes, no.
Yeah, right.
House on stilts? I've never lived in one, so that's a place I've never lived.
Are there coconuts? There are.
Often coconuts are correlated with house on stilts.
Yeah, right. Coconuts, house on stilts. Is the roof made out of tile? Is the tile red?
Is it corrugated?
Is there corrugated roof?
Yeah, I mean, because corrugated it could be metal, or it can be tile, or it can be... Well, don't talk yourself up too much, because here's the thing that stumped me. We are going to spend the next, I hope, around an hour. Please don't let it be 90 minutes. On the island of Bougainville.
Oh, yeah. My dad was there in World War II.
No!
Yeah, it was one of the places that...
Wait, was he island hopping?
He was. He, you know, he flew a C-47 as a Navy pilot, and he hopped from island to island throughout the Pacific War. He would...
Which side?
Interesting.
Yeah, from island to island, avoiding the draft.
he would fly in ammunition and supplies, and they'd land sometimes on strips that were in the middle of being contested, you know, bullets flying. And they'd, you know, guys in the back of the plane are just hucking crates of bullets out the side, sometimes without even, you know, as the plane is taxiing.
Yeah, they're hoping they can get back in the air, right?
Yeah, and all the you know, supplies and stuff. And then they're throwing wounded in the back of the plane.
Oh,
like,
you'd
flip the tail around, and they're like, wounded, hop on! Like, but basically it's a Vietnam helicopter.
It's loading a ferry boat, basically, you know, like... As soon as the bullets are off, the wounded have to come on.
Yeah.
We got to get out of here.
And then off they'd go. So he had all kinds of stories, and he definitely was in Bougainville.
I could not. Yeah, so it's named for the French admiral Louis de Bougainville, who discovered it. And I'm doing the woke quote marks.
Yep.
When I say discovered
it.
When he reached it. I think we now have to start saying reached.
Oh, reached.
Even though it's a little bit weird, because it really seems like he was, you know, doing a fun run, like a like a benefit for cancer or something.
He touched the beach.
He finally reached.
It's in Papua New Guinea, right?
Yes.
New Guinea. My dad said New Guinea a lot.
That's kind of the crux of our story. Is it in New Guinea or not?
Oh.
Even though the French pronunciation would be Bougainville, apparently locals say Bougainville.
Oh.
So maybe I'll stick with that.
Is the plant named after it?
So that's the only way, like I assumed it was Polynesian because, you know, when I see Bougainvillea, you know, it's somewhere Hawaii adjacent. But yes, the flowering plant is named for the explorer on one of his expeditions, but not to Bougainville. So it's like two things named for the same guy.
Oh.
Like.
Oh, but not connected.
Right. I'm not even sure if it grows. Let's see. I don't know which of his expedition it was found on.
Because we call the plant Bougainvillea. Or Bougainvillea.
Yeah, we say Bougainvillea. Yeah. Is that right?
I think so. I think that's what we say. And by we, I mean my mom.
Wikipedia prefers Bougainvillea over Bougainvillea, and so does the dictionary. Mm-hmm. But the islanders on Bougainville, the native people, say Bougainville. Mm-hmm. And they should know. They've been there a while. It's been inhabited for tens of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Although not called Bougainville.
No, it'd be very weird if they predicted predicted the French. Of all the things you could never predict.
The French Revolution.
Among their weapons are, among the weapons of the French are, surprise, reaching Bougainville before anybody else. Mm-hmm. So these are like an Australo-Melanesian people. So they look like the aborigines of Australia. You know, they reached that part of the world from Africa a long, long time ago.
So they're not like Polynesian. They're more like aboriginal.
Yes. They are dark with frizzy hair. They actually call themselves blackskins on that island, you know, later when Papuans and white settlers started to move in, and they called them redskins and whiteskins respectively.
Oh.
So even though to the eyes of a colonizer, I'm sure the Papua New Guineans look exactly like the Bougainvillians.
Oh, now don't reduce colonizers just to one kind of idea.
No, there's probably one super cool missionary who's like, let me measure your skull. These are, my calipers say you are a different tribe.
Yeah, we can't just lump them all together. You know, colonizers had their own version of being woke.
Hashtag not all colonizers. I think one of the ethnological explanations for the difference between the New Guineans and the Bougainvillians is that when the Melanesians arrived from Africa to someplace that was inhabited in Southeast Asia, it might have been inhabited by non-Homo sapien hominins like the Denisovians.
The Denisovians.
So there's like some kind of like, you know, not Neanderthal, but, you know, Homo sapiens adjacent populace there that where interbreeding is possible.
Right.
And so there's like non-African DNA in some of these people because it's a different Denisovian species.
Last thing I thought when I entered the bunker today was that we'd be talking about the Denisovians only 20 minutes in.
No,
12 minutes.
I don't know anything about that. I was as surprised as anybody to read that this is the genetic research on like Filipino Negrito people and, you know, different populations of Aboriginal people around Melanesia.
You were surprised as me because I'm also surprised.
Equally
surprised.
I'm like a 10 right now when it comes to surprise.
Me too.
Until today, I was absolutely confident that Papua New Guineas were 100% Homo sapien DNA.
Yeah.
And now I've been 23andMe'd into thinking, well, what if they're 7% Denisovian?
Well, do you have any sense of how much Neanderthal is in you?
I don't, but when I look in the mirror, it doesn't seem high. Like, I would love to have a little more of a Neanderthal lantern jaw or unibrow. I mean, these are all things that could only help me.
Well, except my mom did a 23andMe and they said in it, oh my God, I hate this whole universe, but that we are more Neanderthal-thal
than the average bear.
And so she is super proud of that.
Sure.
That's some kind of thing.
That's prehistoric wokeness.
That's right.
That's the ultimate interracial love story is like...
It's some kind of Northern European, like, the Neanderthals survived until long past where they'd been exterminated elsewhere. And so, yeah, something where she's
and
just
and maybe
like,
they didn't all get exterminated.
Some and that of them, accounts some for of them our integrated. Hardiness. And she, you know, she's got this whole theory about how it accounts for our ability to withstand
trauma. Well, I never get bug bites. Maybe I'm Neanderthal.
See, there you go.
Do you think that's, are they famous for mosquitoes not liking them?
I bet you they were more in Wales than they were in Spain, or maybe not. Maybe they were more in Spain than they were in Greece. Boy, it's hard for me to keep it all straight. Let's get back to the Denisovians.
Let's, about which we know nothing.
Yeah.
And therefore can speak freely.
Hear, hear.
So there's this kind of ethnic cultural divide that's been there for thousands of years, along with water.
Yeah.
Separating
an ethno-cultural divide and water.
And also the
combined.
And also the hydrological divide that is the ocean. Separate Papua New Guinea from the island of Bougainville. And in fact, Bougainville, you know, if you look at it on a map, it's clearly...
No thanks.
Yeah, which we would never do. It's clearly part of the Solomon Islands archipelago. Oh. So this ties in with your dad's story of island hopping there. It's
It's
a clear path to liberate Southeast Asia. You got to go through Guadalcanal and the other Solomons. And
you know, he got dengue fever.
No way.
Yeah. He had dengue fever and he was in a hospital, but this is his story. He was in a hospital, like a tent hospital, and some general or admiral, I guess, came through and was pinning purple hearts on everybody.
Just willy nilly.
Well, just they're all in the hospital. So purple hearts for everyone.
And I thought there was a form.
There probably was a form. Someone else filled out because they were all sick in bed.
Radar is coming behind him with a clipboard.
And he pinned a purple heart on the sheet, on my dad's sheet, you know, like, here's your purple heart. And my dad rose up heroically and said, I don't deserve a purple heart. I have dengue fever. And the admiral said, well, that is your... You're sick in wartime.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
You're injured in wartime.
Do you qualify if you get malaria because you were
presumably
digging latrines?
Presumably, he would not have it if he'd stayed in Seattle.
Yes, but that's not valor necessary. I mean, it is. He went to a place that had dengue fever, but maybe he didn't look it up.
I think it's harder to be valorous if you're a pilot that doesn't have guns on his plane, although he also has a story about shooting down a Japanese Zero with his sidearm.
That seems a little... That one seems a little less plausible.
It did happen to someone, but I'm not sure, 100% sure if it happened to my dad.
That's a great take on war stories. They are all true of someone.
Of someone.
Probably not the speaker.
Yeah. But he refused the Purple Heart and then later realized that if he had accepted the Purple Heart, that it would have made some difference in his...
In his pension?
Navy pension. And he was like, I should have accepted the Purple Heart. All right, Dad. Move along.
I mean, it's an interesting question. If that's for, like, I had never considered this. Is the Purple Heart meant to represent the physical effects of the injury itself, of the whatever the injury malady is, or is it supposed to represent your inner character? Because, you know, if you get hurt charging a bunker, that's a little different than I got hurt because I licked the wrong leaf.
Well, as someone who's obviously of the two of us more woke, I'm not in the habit of ranking people's disabilities, Ken.
Oh, yeah, but the Army probably is. Presumably,
oh, for sure.
Presumably, there's a file somewhere.
For sure.
Sorry, you're a stage three. You don't get the less falling apart VA hospital.
I'm not sure. I mean, maybe the admiral was trying to make his Purple Heart quota. Because there's probably one of those too. Like, how many Purple Hearts have you written?
Like, he gets called into Nimitz. I need to see everybody's Purple Heart numbers. I don't know if it's good to have your men have more Purple Hearts. That's not a sign of anything.
It's a sign of valor.
I guess. My men are so brave, they get injured three times as much.
I prefer soldiers that don't get injured.
Exactly. Well, they're much more effective the next day. I mean, just from a tactical standpoint. So, despite its connection, so the island of Bougainville is part of the Solomons, but as you know, if you said you're not going to look at a map, you know who else didn't really look at maps a lot when it was writing treaties and dividing the world was the British Empire.
Oh, for sure. I mean, they looked at maps. They just disregarded all geography.
They're
in
just
favor
like,
of...
let's draw a straight line across them. So this is kind of interesting because you think of these colonialist issues happening you know, in a straight line across a desert, Iraq or Mali and Mauritania, you know, and then all the problems that later happen with the Bedouins and the Kurds that are left right on the wrong side of an arbitrary line drawn in London or Paris. But this is a case where an island is assigned to the wrong place. It's assigned Germany, Bismarck's German Empire has a foothold in New Guinea.
Oh, this is happening that late. I guess, yeah, the colonial period.
Yeah, well, I mean, it gets visited various times over the years.
The Dutch are there.
But people in European conference rooms keep placing Bougainville with New Guinea instead of
Solomon Islands.
And I think the heart of it is a trade that happens pretty late in the 19th century between the UK and Bismarck's Germany, where Germany gets Bougainville and the UK gets Western Samoa. You know, and a player to be named later, and an island to be named later, and maybe cash consideration.
Does that seem like a fair trade?
They're just, I don't know.
In the poker game?
I didn't have Baseball Abstract at the time, but that's the kind of thing that they were doing. You know, fine. And what that means is Bougainville got stripped from the Solomons, where it would have naturally, geographically and ethnically belonged, culturally, and placed with New Guinea. And this leads to problems about a century later. As always, these things were forestalled by World War I and then World War II. Australia took Bougainville with New Guinea from the Germans at the end of World War I. So now it's back to being British-y. Uh-huh. But then Japan seizes it as part of their Pacific Empire. And then at the end of World War II, it's once again British-y when Australia takes it back. And its grouping with New Guinea means that in 1975, when Papua New Guinea, the eastern half of the island becomes independent, Bougainville had tried 2 weeks before Papua New Guinea declared independence. Bougainville had tried and say, "We also declare independence. We're the independent nation of Bougainville," but they are not their claim is not recognized internationally, and they stay part of Papua New Guinea. And throughout this time period, even the late colonial period, foreigners have been coming in. The Papuan, you know, the gold is discovered, and then later an extremely rich copper deposit is discovered.
Are the foreigners all? Do they also consider the Papua New Guineans foreigners in this context?
Yeah. So once their new white visitors discover gold and copper, a bunch of white money pours in, and bringing with it cheap migrant labor from across the strait in Papua New Guinea. And so these are the people that the locals start to consider redskins. So you know, and that's a huge group. Tens of thousands of laborers pour in, and different tribes and clans start to form. You know, it changes the kind of the political face, the complexion of the island. A consortium that comes to be called the Bougainville Copper Limited, BCL, in 1957 starts what becomes the biggest open pit mine in the world.
What?
And if you've, you know, it no longer is, because if you've been to Salt Lake City, you've probably seen the old Kennecott mine.
That's a very big mine.
Out west. It's so big you can see it in town because it changed the shape of the mountains. You can just look, you know, 30 miles away or whatever that is and be like, oh, that mountain now looks like a strip mine. A
lot of copper under there.
And it's owned by the same outfit that BCL is a subsidiary by the end of the 20th century, a subsidiary of Rio Tinto Zinc.
Oh, I know those guys.
So I don't, except for the fact that as a former Utahn, I know that they now have you'd think all these shady strip mining conglomerates would stay under the radar, but they bought the naming rights to the soccer stadium in Salt Lake.
Really?
So yeah, the MSL Utah team, Real Salt Lake, which is...
Is now called...
Which is a terrible name and another story. They play at Rio Tinto Stadium, I think. So,
and Rio Tinto, as far as I understand it, is named after a Spanish mine, but it's actually an Australian company?
Is that right?
Something like that. It's like it's one of these things where people were buying, mining companies were buying other mining companies.
Yes.
And at some point they were like, this Rio Tinto name's pretty good.
Yeah, it's I could see it being an Australian company because now it's headquartered in the UK. And I don't even think it's still Rio Tinto zinc. It's weird that Rio Tinto zinc is opening a copper mine, because at some point they're going to be like, wait a second.
There's no zinc here.
This isn't zinc. Because the main thing that they want when they pull something out of the ground is it for it to be zinc.
Hmm. Well, you would think.
But copper is very valuable. And so the Panguna mine in what was once a lush forest now becomes a 3-square-mile ugly hole in the ground.
Uh-huh. Are there beautiful holes in the ground? There are.
Hole? What's the prettiest hole? It might be Jackson Hole.
There are really nice holes. What? All those places down in
Belize, right? Those cenotes or whatever.
Cenotes.
What a great hole.
They are super beautiful holes.
I like how at the beginning of The Hobbit, Tolkien has to be like, now this dude lives in a hole. But let me tell you, before you go too crazy, it's a super nice hole. Like, we've all seen crappy holes because he'd been in the war.
Sure. But right. He's seen some crappy holes.
Yeah, he's been up to his knees in sewage for 2 winters in a row, probably. But this is a super nice hole. The doors are painted green. There's a larder with cold chicken. So there are a few nice holes, but this was not one of them.
So here's something I just looked up, because as frequent listeners will understand, we both have computers.
Mm.
Copper is currently $4.24 a pound.
Which is why all the EV chargers around me are getting slashed by tweakers.
But zinc is $2,800 a ton.
If they're doing ton, it must be cheaper.
You got to think. But $2,800 a ton.
Yeah, that means it's just over a dollar, you know, it's a dollar and change a pound, right?
But in April of 2020, it was all the way up to $4,300 a ton. So the price of zinc is really fluctuating.
But even so, even at its highest, that's roughly half what copper's getting.
So maybe Rio Tinto zinc is like trying to conceal their copper fortunes.
Maybe they're just trying to make brass. They're like, if we get enough copper and then we get enough zinc, we have a... Well, no, wait, that's not right.
Rio Tinto.
Is it? Now I'm like, wait, is copper and zinc. Is brass tin and zinc, or is it copper and zinc?
Bronze, copper and zinc are...
Bronze is copper and tin, right?
Oh, wait, now, I mean, I Googled it, and now all of a sudden it's like, oh, if you take zinc, brass, you should also take copper.
Brass is copper and zinc.
Yeah.
So these guys are trying to corner the market on brass.
But it's also supplements, so they might be like a natural vitamin.
They're like, the second you get any stuffy nose, Rio Tinto wants you to stuff zinc up it. So as you can imagine, this changes the complexion of the island. A ton of people have to get resettled, and they are put in pretty awful shanty towns, because what used to be their lush jungle paradise is now
hole in the ground. You're saying that the huge hole in the ground actually displaced the people that were living around it.
Yeah, and then company towns accrete around it. $3 billion in profit is made by BCL, Bougainville Copper Limited, over the next few decades.
Seems like a good amount of profit.
No, it's not bad. Yeah. Listen.
Yeah, sure.
If I can make $3 billion in profit, I wouldn't bulldoze somebody's jungle, but I'd look into it.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, are there ways I could get like most of that without displacing any indigenous people?
Seems like it's probably being used for more than supplements.
That would be a lot of cold stuff. A lot of cold medicine. It's estimated that maybe 1/1,000th of that $3 billion actually went to the people of Bougainville.
I'm surprised it was that much.
Yeah, exactly.
1/1,000th?
That's pretty good. That's like $3 million.
Well, wait a minute. Is that? It 3 is. Billion. 1/1,000th of 3 billion is 3 million?
Yes. We just did the Fermi problems.
Yeah, show. That seems like not very much when you really break it down.
Yeah, in mid 20th century dollars, it'll build you a couple of schools, you know, but...
3 million.
Yeah. And who knows if it went to the right Bougainvillians.
I'm going to guess it didn't.
I bet there are some Bougainvillains.
Oh.
And they're getting maybe a little more than their share.
That's the kind of thing that you would think of to say that I never would think of to say.
And even if you did, it would annoy you and you wouldn't say it.
Yeah. Maybe I would have thought of it and my brain would have just sluiced it out.
In later retellings of this mining operation, what really sticks in the craw of these people, and it's, you know, it's difficult to tell how much of this is, you know, hindsight history, but 1 billion tons of copper mining mineral runoff flowed down, I think, the Jaba River, which flowed through the Panguna site.
Oh, it was also a Superfund site.
Full of all kinds of metals that are not good to put in your watershed, including lead and arsenic. So what was this just unimaginably beautiful, pristine jungle just became like a moonscape. Like, not just like, there's not as many fish as there used to be, but literally like, all the fish died, all the plants died, nobody can drink from the water, and it's going to be that way for centuries. Like, this was a 200-year kind of a Superfund impact. And in 1988, I think this was an early mine employee, a guy named Francis Ona, gets together with, calls for a meeting with some of the villagers to meet with the landowners and to demand reparations. Like, you know, our people are dying, villages are having to move, and he gets laughed out of the room.
Yeah, that'll happen.
So the villagers immediately leave the meeting, head for the mining depot where they still have either keys or bolt cutters, and immediately liberate like 50,000, I didn't write down units, either pounds or dollars, we may never know,
okay,
of high explosives.
Okay.
From the Bougainville Copper Limited, and immediately launch into kind of a monkey wrench gang kind of eco-terrorism campaign.
Wow.
The meeting could have gone better.
Yeah.
You know, all they had to do was be like, we hear your concerns and we're going to form a committee.
Maybe the worst kind of meeting result. Although,
but maybe,
no, maybe blowing everybody up is the worst.
I mean, in this case, it was great for getting something done because they immediately saw, we're never going to have a political solution here. It's time to monkey wrench our way to getting the copper guys out.
You know, as a teenager, I really was...
These were all your solutions.
I was a strong believer in stealing dynamite from mining companies and taking the law into your own hands by blowing up the Hoover Dam.
Did you ever do it?
No. But you know, that was during the era when I was a teenager, that was the era where eco warriors were filling bulldozer gas tanks with sand and
putting those rebar in
spiking trees,
in old growth trees, so that chainsaws would pop back and take somebody's head off.
It turns out that it didn't end logging.
No, we needed an owl for that.
The owl was the thing that ended the logging. You never know what it's going to be.
In this case, the Papuan New Guinea government, which, you know, controls the island of Bougainville thanks to this German-UK 19th century accident of geopolitics, basically one half of the country's export earnings are BCL copper coming from this little island they kind of lucked into off their eastern coast. And
it's the part of the GNP... Yeah. Of the island, but not of Papua New Guinea.
No, that is half of Papua New Guinea's exports.
You're kidding.
Are copper from this massive mine. It's an incredibly rich load. And so they cannot screw around with local troublemakers. And so they immediately send in the riot police to be like, we got a law enforcement problem here.
Is Papua New Guinea a liberal democracy?
In 1988? Yeah, like a lot of those former British Empire countries in Africa and the Caribbean who all got independence around this time. It's, you know, Papua New Guinea is still a Commonwealth realm. So it has the setup you would expect with...
It's
Queen Elizabeth and a ceremonial governor general and then a prime minister leading a parliamentary democracy. Like, the UK left its stamp on a lot of these places before it saw fit to let them out of the empire. But I'm not going to say that it's entirely untroubled by corruption or bad law enforcement because the police come in and immediately just don't make any friends. They just start beating heads, burning down villages.
That's strange that would be a characteristic of the police.
They're called riot police because they start riots. That's why they get their name. And basically, they cause enough havoc to turn what was kind of a... you know, spectator populace, you know, some of whom needed the mining jobs, some of whom were resentful about the outside power, some of whom were racist against the migrant labor, you know, a lot of different kinds of feelings. But now they all agree they hate the Papua New Guinea government, who shouldn't even be their government,
right?
Sending in the cops. And it's enough to form what later became known as the BRA, the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, a kind of a militia group coalesces out of the jungle.
Now, are they, this may be jumping ahead, but are they kind of allied slash fellow travelers with the, at the time, very popular Red Army slash IRA slash ETA world of revolutionaries?
They're on a tiny island, half a world away from even, you know, I don't know where the nearest angle. I mean, I guess the Viet Cong, you know, you've got, right, okay, you've got what's going on in Indochina, but they're pretty far from Angola and Colombia and, you know, wherever these leftist jungle rebel groups, Nicaragua, are likely to be hanging out. And so they kind of become their own thing. Like I watched, there's a very good documentary. The name Coconut Revolution comes from a 2001 documentary that was made by a British TV crew visiting the islands in the waning days of the war. Uh-huh. And they spend time with Francis Ona, the guy who stalked out of the meeting and decided to start blowing up miners. He's kind of a jolly, I want to say village grandfather in a way that does not make you think of Ho Chi Minh, mm-hmm, because he's not like kind of a wise sage. He's educated
in Paris.
Exactly. He's just a guy with a big frizzy beard and a twinkle in his eye. And he's always wearing like kind of beige walking shorts and a polo.
Sounds like me.
Yeah. It looks like he just got back from golfing when he's on vacation in the Caribbean or something. And he's a real man of the people. He has some story about being in school and coming upon the principal one day plunging a toilet. And he's like, "Sir, you're the principal. You don't have to plunge a toilet." And he's like, "This is what real leaders do. You know, you got to get down in the dirt."
Yeah.
And Ona kind of expresses that as his origin story. So he's going to be, you know, when he's, in addition to being the leader of this, you know, the equivalent of their Ho Chi Minh, he's also just gardening and chopping brush with a machete. And,
regular folks.
He's a regular kind of a jolly village uncle guy.
Now, can I ask, you know, in Polynesia, there's a big part of their culture is that they are warriors. Mm-hmm. Is that also true of the Bougainvillians? Do they have a similar kind of like it would be part of their culture to fight, or would that not be?
I don't see it as much as there doesn't seem to be an equivalent of the Maori Haka, for example. They've all been Christianized pretty effectively by early British contact.
That'll happen.
Which is interesting.
It was true for me too.
And so so Ona is also kind of a preacher figure with very kind of charismatic, kind of preacher man, loud prayers and sermons.
Right.
About how Jesus is going to save them and judge their enemies. And it's syncretic. They also are putting magic herbs on their guns so that the bullets will make snakes grow on their enemies. You know, there's
a little bit of cargo cult.
Yeah. There's whatever their Melanesian tribal religion was is still there. But they seem to be lovers, not fighters. And in particular, they don't have any weaponry. You know, this revolutionary army has been created by a ill-advised police incursion, but they don't actually have any international allies. Right. You know, the East is not sending them guns. The West is not sending them guns. Again, they're on a little tiny island in the Solomons. But when the New Guinea government, and they're also their acronym is BRA, B-R-A, which is
tougher to sell
maybe
to an anti-mining. I mean, this was
women don't like bras, men find them troublesome.
This was during the beginning of the environmental movement or shortly thereafter. So there would have been Western allies.
They have
hippies.
I mean, the books they have are not, you know, whole earth catalog kinds of stuff. You know, the books they have are like guerrilla tactics kind of books, you know, to the degree that, there's no internet.
Right.
To the degree that there is any kind of, publishing or thought or, school of philosophy around what they're doing, I don't know how aware they are of, you know, for example, eco warriors in the U.S.
Do you think it might have been the Anarchist Cookbook?
Absolutely. That is. I was like, what's the name of the book we did a show on? And then I said the Whole Earth Catalog. But I meant the Anarchist Cookbook. They don't have weapons, so they have, you know, they're, it's a David and Goliath story in that literally they are starting off with slingshots. The riot police having been ineffective, Papua New Guinea sends in its army, the PNGDF, Papua New Guinea Defense Forces, and they have helicopters from Australia. For whatever reason, Australia decides to change its own laws. They suspend the Foreign Crimes Act.
Uh-huh.
And if you ever suspend your nation's Foreign Crimes Act, you're probably up to no good, right?
Let's go commit some crimes.
To send in helicopters and train pilots. I guess they do not want a popular uprising happening in their sphere of influence against a powerful European extraction company.
Right.
So they are just interested in keeping the peace here. And by peace, they mean keep the copper flowing.
Right.
So they send in helicopters, and all the BRA has are these kind of, it looks like they've modified a rifle, but to make some kind of weird slingshot crossbow hybrid.
So no, not really.
You kind of ka-chunk it like a crossbow, but it's got a little leather pouch with rubber, with an elastic strap.
I'm going to say that's rad. But also,
it's pretty rad, but they're fighting helicopter gunships.
Yeah, not like effective. Rad, but not effective.
I mean, it's the most literal David and Goliath fight ever because they are using slingshots.
Right.
I guess it's not a literal. There's not a literal helicopter in the David and Goliath story.
As far as we know.
As far as the Bible records. And they're, you know, they have a machine shop so they can, you know, seize old scrap metal, mining goods, whatever they can get from mining detritus. They are also milling and metalworking into metals. But their main approach is just like, okay, how do we use this slingshot to steal a rifle?
It's a raider war.
Exactly. And they do. They start to arm themselves. You know, okay, how many slings are going to take to get one SLR? Okay, now that we have a rifle, what can we... And they gradually start to arm themselves.
This is kind of how the the Plains tribes fought the cavalry.
You said cavalry.
Yeah, I
know. You had to think about it for a second.
I mean, I did like work my way through
cavalry.
The word.
Cavalry. Backward masking. And they start to be successful to the degree that in 1990, Papua New Guinea decides to, with the help of Australia, blockades the whole island.
1990.
The funny thing about this is going on during the Bush and Clinton era. Do you remember?
Vaguely.
A civil war? I do not. It's the longest and worst war in the Pacific since World War II ended.
Yeah.
15,000 people, locals died by many estimates, mostly because of the lack of food and medicine caused by the blockade. And I don't remember it on the news.
The thing is,
next to Bosnia.
Yeah, this would have been during a time, during a media age, where you would be dependent on the New York Times and Time Magazine, and
I bet every 3 years there was a page on.
Yeah,
like, you've never heard of this rebel group, but they're making gains in the West
for sure. But you know, this was also an era of rebel groups.
Right, it was all a blur.
Yeah, and sort of, you know, and post-colonial, but still not quite all the way post-colonial. I mean, and think about all of the different groups that were fighting exactly this kind of war in various African states, you know, and often connected to mining and resource extraction. So I do have a vague sense of it, but... You know, it was for sure overshadowed by Imelda Marcos's shoes in terms of like print inches from, you know, from Southeast Asia. And not to say that the Philippines are Southeast Asia.
I feel like I was only aware of the Contras, who are a terrible stand-in for all these leftist jungle activists, because they were not.
But 1990, you know, that would have been maybe...
Yeah, we're moving into...
Post-Big Contra. FARC.
We're moving into FARC... territory. Yeah. And what were the Angolan guys called?
But also, you know, that was 1990 was right as we were about to invade Iraq for the first time. So column inches is what we're talking about. And column inches got parsed.
We were not getting them where I lived anyway. The blockade ends up being a huge problem. Like, unlike, you know, rebel territory in the Colombian jungle or the Angolan highlands or whatever, like, you can shut off an island.
Right.
Suddenly, the BRA has no food or medicine. Hmm. And so Francis Ona, like, true to kind of his eco-warrior roots, he decides we need to make every family on the island self-sufficient. He starts a huge gardening initiative. And it turns out...
Victory Gardens.
Basically, except Bougainville has this kind of Eden-like rich soil. It is literally an Edenic garden.
Yeah.
And so people can grow sweet potatoes and cassava and corn and tomatoes and potatoes and onions and taro and
cocoa
and all the rest. And maybe the most crucial crop of them all for subsistence, coconuts. These people use, and the reason why the documentary is called Coconut Revolution. It's kind of coconut powered. These people use every part of the coconut.
Huh.
They.
What do you use a husk of a coconut for?
You burn it to keep away mosquitoes.
Sure.
You weave the leaves into baskets. The milk has medicinal properties, so when you come back with blisters from your long march through enemy territory, you put coconut milk.
Have you ever seen someone weave a basket from coconut? Not fronds. What are they?
They could be fronds. It's fronds. A palm tree. They do seem. They do seem thinner than a frond.
It's a phenomenal thing.
I have, thanks to the oddly elaborate Polynesian cultural center of Oahu.
Yeah.
That the Mormons gift tourists with.
That is such a big complex. It's like you're driving like on the backside of Oahu, and then you come upon this town that's got this massive...
And it does have some like kind of Disney Aulani-like theme park quality. It's all beautifully... The Mormons are the Disney of religion. You know, there's no litter. Everybody's in...
And there's a temple. The perfect tribal costume. You know, strangely enough, there's a temple there also. But like a big... Suddenly you're in this world of like a big circular road with landscaping. And, you know, and there's normal Oahu dwellings all nearby.
That was my memory of it too. The kids loved it. I was like, this might be lame. And the kids were like, this is like a theme park. That guy's shimmying up a tree. We can go on a boat. They're doing fire dancing.
Yeah.
It's a good time.
But the baskets and the way they use the weaving, it's just like nutty cool. Nutty and cool.
The main thing, I mean, the baskets and the mosquito repellent and the blister gel is all great. But mm-hmm. as you can imagine, the most valuable thing to a blockaded army is...
Milk and meat.
Yeah, you can eat the meat, but you can also like grape stomp the hell out of the meat and ferment it into oil, coconut oil. And these guys figure out how to make diesel fuel, basically.
I thought you were going to say booze. But
they figure out how to make booze, and the revolution ends.
I mean, but diesel fuel is just a kind of booze, I guess.
So these guys are driving their Jeeps all over the island.
Whoa.
On coconut diesel. It turns out that it is less polluting. It has twice the mileage of regular diesel. I guess
the exhaust smells like suntan lotion.
Yeah, exactly. It smells like a piña colada everywhere when you get out of the car. From 15 coconuts, you can get a full liter of gas.
You're kidding.
And this is what keeps the BRA's revolution going through what turns into a nearly decade-long blockade.
You know, coconuts fall in profusion. 5 coconuts for a liter of diesel seems like a pretty good extraction rate.
I was kind of wondering because, you know, this documentary I'm watching is making this scene, is framing it as kind of the first successful eco-revolution. Like these simple village people have an idea of an ecotopia and they are eager to show the foreign press, hey, we've got hydro here. And they do. They keep, mm-hmm. you know, while the PNGDF, while the army camps have rolling blackouts, these guys are getting 24-hour hydro from the mountain streams. I do have to wonder, like, really, is planting coconut palms and extracting tropical oils, is that, you know, we would be against an American company doing that. But as long as it's an eco-army.
You know, what's funny is in the early 90s, there was, in Seattle, a rage for eco-diesel.
Real? Oh, yeah.
That was made out of French fry oil. And so when
you have to modify your car, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, you drive a Mercedes 300D or some kind of, like, you just had to change the filters and one other thing. But there was, I worked as a short order cook in 90, 91.
You had all these guys, all these BMW drivers coming back and being like, hey, I'll give you $20 for that French fry
oil. We had these huge barrels of, like, French fry oil, and people at first would come and we'd be like, great, take it, because it's cheap, you know, it's free, and we have to pay somebody to schlep it. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden there was a sense of like, wait a minute, this is worth money. And so then people tried to charge for it, but somehow that all went away. Nobody's like stealing French fry. I mean, you know, you would see a Mercedes 300D drive by and it smelled like French fries.
Is the idea that you have to modify the engine, right?
Not the engine, but something. part of the diesel. But it's not a massive. I had a girlfriend at the time who wanted to buy a Mercedes 300D station wagon, and she saw one for $2,500 or something. And I said, "You have no idea what the maintenance costs of that are going to be. You're making $4.25 an hour as a barista, and don't get into the diesel conversion Mercedes racket." And then that one sold, and she was so mad at me because the next diesel Mercedes she saw was $3,000, and she was like, I'll never, you know, it's a price bubble now and everybody's gonna have one and I'll never get one now.
Lesson
thanks
learned.
To you.
Always impulse buy everything.
I was like, okay.
Yeah,
I saved her actually. I did all my girlfriends.
What was it? The Prius? The Prius stopped the
No,
well, I guess people started using that awful corn ethanol, but don't we know that's bad?
That's really bad.
That's just car people who think it's better for their car.
Well, I think it's big corn.
Yeah, but the people who buy it aren't just fooled by big corn, are they? Maybe they are.
We're all fooled by big corn.
They just see a leaf. I go to BP because the logo is green. I'm like, I love the earth. These are the good fossil fuels. Sorry about that. Sorry about the Deepwater Horizon thing. In hindsight, like, this is a lot messier than this. This documentary is great. It's, you know, fascinating to watch, you know, the equivalent of a anime eco-utopia wage war against. Ona says, we could beat New Guinea in a week, but Australia is going to take a little longer.
Yeah, you
know, effectively, they're...
That's a pretty good quote.
Effectively, they're facing, you know, the whole developed world.
Is there hydropower, like, just basically little, like, mini water wheels?
It's a water
wheel.
Yeah, it's water wheel. So if you've ever seen some amazing ecotopia in a sci-fi movie or an anime, like, it appears to have existed, but I think a lot of it might have been for the TV. You know, you read a lot about how the revolution there was pretty messy. BRA was not a bunch of you see them singing, you know, Ona loves, you know, gospel music, and so there's like a little music station where everybody can come and play these fun hollow drums or like learn how to play guitar and...
For some of us, though, the idea that this is a Christian revolution is also like
it's surprising, like, right?
Well, and photo op kind of problematic.
You want them to have, yeah. You want it to be some kind of a shamanic. That's not right. Shamanic. You want there to be a village elder who's telling them visions of how they're going to win a battle. And in fact, this is happening. They are deciding, okay, we need to hold off on this offensive because Joseph had a vision.
Oh.
But it's like a Christian vision. Like, Jesus told me we need to attack on the West, you know?
Yeah, this is the type of thing that Western observers are like, well, but Christian missionaries are the ones that are bad in so many of these stories.
Apparently that ship has sailed a century later. Maybe you get a broader coalition. Then you get like, you know, you get like... mega churches in Texas donating to your Christian revolution at the same time as you get hippies in Oregon sending you supplies. I don't know.
I know, but that's the coalition that's currently active in Jerusalem too.
So it all seems very idyllic when they're, you know, claiming that their bush medicine can cure malaria and even AIDS. At one point in the documentary, they imply that they have a revolutionary cure for AIDS that maybe the West should be looking into.
There's very little AIDS, I bet, on the island at the time. It seems kind of speculative because that AIDS is in the news a lot.
There's one HIV positive outsider, they say, who has responded very well to their traditional herbal treatments. Oh, and they're doing herbal booby traps. You know, they're, you know, people are, it's kind of a, we do everything the Viet Cong does, but in like, kind of an eco, like the Batman villain Poison Ivy. Like, you know, they tried to cross our lines, but now they have, now they got weird medical problems. Their testicles are now swelling up because they crossed our row of testicle plant or whatever. That's actually an example from the movie. But I know in real life it was a dirtier war. You know, there were lots of just violent kind of criminal splinter groups who claimed to be part of the BRA and controlled different areas, and they were basically plundering and running all the kind of murder and rape camps you were imagining in any civil war. So
can confirm.
So it's not some perfect, because really in hindsight, what you take from this war is that the plot of the movie Avatar actually happened once.
Whoa.
You know, the people of the jungle were sick of the mine, rose up on their dragons with their slingshots and outlasted their oppressor. It's called Panguna instead of Pandora, but I've never seen this really talked about. Like, you know, James Cameron has never been like, I was inspired by the Bougainville Civil War, but there are in the South Pacific media, many people have noticed, like, why isn't anybody realizing Avatar is based on Bougainville?
Oh, and do they see it as a...
In that sphere of the world, they're like, clearly, clearly this is a version of the Bougainville Civil War. Because the Coconut Revolution, just like in the first Avatar, ends up being successful. By the late 90s, the BRA holds maybe 80% of the island.
No way.
PNG, DF soldiers are basically demoralized. It's you know, the equivalent of a Vietnam scenario, but in a much smaller microcosm. Like, why are we even here? We don't want to be here either.
Are they throwing to... Is there a government?
Yeah, there is...
A new government.
Yeah, there's actually kind of a Ho Chi Minh-like scenario where Francis Ona is not wanting to participate in the peace talks and does not think any concessions should be made. The peace talks go on for most of the 90s and seem to hang up on the issue of will there be and when will there be a referendum for Bougainville to choose independence? Because everybody's kind of in agreement that we can stop the war and ameliorate the mining impacts and end the blockade, et cetera, but you're still going to be part of New Zealand. And there is
New Zealand.
Sorry, that would be, what a twist.
Wow.
You're we want to get rid of you and we want you to be New Zealand's problem.
Uh-huh.
No, you know, you still have to be politically a province of New Guinea. And
but
this is the whole
Solomon up. Islands are a government.
That's a sovereign nation.
There's like 15 or 20 islands in Solomon Islands.
But it's one country, just like Fiji or Samoa have many islands.
And are the Solomon Islands trying to assert any kind? Are they involved at all, or they're just like, leave us out?
Yeah, I think because the division of Bougainville from, you know, their cultural sphere happened over a century ago, I think there's no sense that we want to rejoin our beloved Solomon Islands. And whatever, you know, a lot of those governments were not in great shape at that time anyway. Bougainville is, you know, the leadership of Bougainville is starry-eyed dreamers who want their own Revolutionary War style independence.
Right. And it's a big enough island that it could be
it's plausible, it's a viable
country. It's,
there's many, many smaller Polynesian and Melanesian and Micronesian nations than a hypothetical Bougainville Republic. Ona tells the world press, you know, first we want to maintain our culture, then we want to maintain the environment for our children, and then we care about independence. So he's explicitly not a freedom fighter. But his vice president, you know, the second in charge of the BRA,
is a lieutenant colonel with an eye patch.
Is a guy named Joseph Kabui, and he is clearly interested in power. He's the one leading the negotiations with New Guinea and Australia. He seems like the one who's the realist who might take over a government, and who knows if it will be a good or a bad government. But what finally ends New Guinea's war is a terrible mistake that is made in 1997 when the Papua New Guinea government, in conjunction with Australia, realizes their own army is not working. They decide to pay $36 million to a shadowy UK mercenary outfit called Sandine.
Good Lord.
So this is basically the plot of a you know, a slow horses episode or something. You know, it's it's one of these creepy Rhodesian outfits.
With a bunch of lieutenant colonels full of eye patches.
So, yeah, suddenly a bunch of weird guys in berets are getting on cargo planes.
They're like, I was in Zimbabwe.
And with all the worst accents you can imagine.
That was kind of an Australian accent. I'm never able to do those.
Also, they would never say Zimbabwe.
Like, that's right.
Yeah. They would. Sorry. And it's an amazing thing that happens in what's now called the Sandine Affair. The PNGDF, the New Guinean Army, is furious and...
Because they're like, we were doing fine.
Well, they're just like, what, you're going to bring in these guys to take over our chain of command? You know, we don't want to be here, but we especially don't want these yo-yos.
Right.
So they all defect and turn on the mercenaries and send them packing.
But not on behalf of Bougainvillea, just in their own third front.
Right. It does turn out to be a great act, you know, in defense of the BRA, because they did not want to start fighting Rhodesia-style mercenaries. But that's kind of the last gasp. The peace talks start to center around Bougainville becoming an autonomous province. And that is how the war ends, a successful, reasonably successful eco-revolution in which the mining is stopped and the bows and arrows beat the helicopters. About a tenth of the island, as much of a tenth of the island is dead, mostly due to starvation and disease in the blockade.
Oh, the population.
Of the entire population of the island. Because there's only like 150,000 people there or something like that. But on their scale.
Yeah, not to minimize the death of 15,000 people, but.
Right. But there, that's a bigger deal than it would be if that many people die in, you know, Sarajevo or
Seattle.
Or Fallujah or Seattle.
We could lose 15,000 people and it would just improve traffic.
We'd love it. So they become an autonomous province and it's still.
Now what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. It seems like they're kind of splitting the baby. So they're kind of a Puerto Rico-like, slightly self-sovereign outpost that's still part of Papua New Guinea.
Right. And their passports are from Papua New Guinea.
Exactly. But they have maybe, as a province, they have more self-determination than your average Papua New Guinean province, but maybe less than your average U.S. state due to the weirdness of our federalism.
Now, if you look at a picture of Bougainvillea from Bougainville.
Bougainville. Bougainvillea is the flower.
Bougainville. From the air, as you are able to do through Google Maps.
Or if you're in a C-47.
Or in a C-47. You can see now that the mines are visible from space, if you zoom in.
3 square miles.
And are overgrown. Now.
Oh, that's great.
They're all green. You can still see them, you know, the scar in the land, but they're all green, except for one, I think.
I wonder to what degree that's because the copper was getting more expensive to extract. You know, like, to what degree is the load running dry, and does that correspond with political will?
Weathered copper is also green, although it's a different color of green than jungle.
I think that would stand out in the jungle. But the question that was holding up the peace talks remains, will Bougainville ever be independent? After his vice president Joseph Kabui kind of bailed on him, Francis Ona named himself the king of his particular part of Bougainville, of like Makanui or Malakui or something like that, and he died of malaria in 2005. So I guess the bush medicine wasn't perfect. But he was actively discouraging people from taking part in his rivals' peacemaking and peacemaking efforts and referenda. You know, he was a holdout in the mountains.
The record of post-colonial independence movements that result in separatist kings is not super good. That's not usually how democracy flourishes.
I didn't realize until I saw the Ken Burns Civil War that like Ho Chi Minh was basically checked out for the last 10 years of the war wanted peace too. And it was just, what's his name? But in 2019, it finally happened. 98.3%. So a referendum was held in Bougainville asking them, do you want more autonomy or do you want full-on independence? And fully 98.3% of the populace, now that ONA is not discouraging the vote anymore, voted for independence.
For independence. Seems like, seems like what you would do.
And the problem is the Papua New Guinea government, it's not a binding referendum. The Papua New Guinea government has only subsequently agreed to those terms if parliament ratifies independence, which is very funny.
If their own parliament.
If we decide to ratify your independence, then you will be independent in 2027. Uh-huh. So they have a date, but it hinges on their parliament ratifying it.
2027.
Yeah, so there could be, in just 3 years, a new nation on Earth.
And so what, do you have any sense of what the feeling within the Papua New Guinea parliament / Papua New Guinea population is regarding Bougainville independence? Is it one of these things where if this was happening as part of the United States, there would be a lot of members of a liberal left coalition that would be arguing within the continental states. But is that true in Papua New Guinea, or are the New Guineans all like, screw those guys?
Yeah, I don't even know if there is a party of Bougainville should be independent versus not. Like maybe it's just a political non-issue there, the way we would rarely think about a separatist movement in the U.S. Virgin Islands or something, you know, like.
Right. Puerto Rican independence really plays into long-term Democratic Party thinking.
Exactly.
Because they're like, if we had one more state, plus if there are 52 states, you know, the District of Columbia, boy, we could have a Democratic.
Well, but I guess this would be the opposite, because the party that, party that is supportive of Bougainville would lose some of their representation should it become an independent. It's like the opposite of the Puerto Rico incentives.
Like, is Bougainville actually keeping the environmental, like, coconut diesel community in Papua New Guinea?
I can't imagine that continued after the war. It seems like that was useful discourse with Western media. But still, you know, like, if they've got hydro infrastructure that, like, lets you have electricity in your village, I bet that know-how.
So where continues. Do you fall on this? Having watched the documentary, are you who do you side with? I know who you side with, because you're Ken Jennings, revolutionary.
Oh yeah,
global revolutionary.
That's right. I always stand with eco warriors on dragons. I guess I'm a little worried that there's all these Avatar movies. If it means there's going to be more war in Bougainville.
Oh, because they're like,
yeah. Now they have to go out to the coral reef and find a new revolutionary army that's still fighting the miners.
I mean, that's the thing. Ever since Moana came out, you know, the Polynesians are like back at it.
Yeah. Bougainville too, the way of water.
And that concludes the Coconut Revolution. Entry 239.JE0207. Certificate number 54146 in the omnibus. Futurelings, social media is no help to you now or to any of us. Although, I do have to say that I have seen videos of people building hydroelectric generators in little streams throughout Southeast Asia. And I love those videos. I will watch somebody build a hydroelectric power plant out of bamboo all day and all night. So in that sense,
it's maybe magic. It's a babbling brook that's giving them light.
But I do feel like it's social media that has shown that to me rather than the New York Times. So I no longer am reliant on the column inches of mass media to show me all the wonderful things. Unfortunately, I have to wade through thousands of Instagram posts of people telling me that ADHD actually helps them get their laundry done if I use the following 5 easy steps. It's the five easy steps Instagram. Have you noticed this on social media?
I'm getting fed different stuff than you, I think.
Five easy steps to...
But yes.
To figuring out how to, I don't know, manage your waffles.
People love steps.
They do. I watched a guy yesterday put six containers of dry top ramen in a pan, cover it with spaghetti sauce and cheese, and then bake it in the oven. And the spaghetti sauce is enough to cook the ramen. And then basically he made lasagna out of ramen noodles. So this is, I mean, I'm in the habit of saying social media is no good, but I just learned how to make top ramen lasagna, Ken. So now I'm not, now I'm really confused. I don't know what to do.
I bet you haven't made it yet.
Well, no. No, I'm not even sure I will make it, but that's the problem. Social media is garbage. Don't go there. But if you do, go to @OmnibusProject, @KenJennings, and @JohnRoderick. You'll see that my social media feed now is mostly trying to get you to go to Long Winter shows, which if you live in Seattle, it's a lot easier than if you live elsewhere.
Yeah, you're not playing Bougainville anytime soon?
No. Well, who knows?
By the way, I found an article in what appears to be some Asia-Pacific version of The Economist saying that basically it's tricky.
Oh.
Nobody wants to give up, even though the current New Guinean prime minister is sympathetic. Everybody estimates there's maybe $60 billion worth of copper and gold still on Bougainville.
Oopsie.
You might just not want to hand that off. Plus, I think everybody's worried about instability in the Solomons next door, et cetera, et cetera.
It's one thing after another.
It's complicated.
Yep. Soviet Union back involved.
Probably.
You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com and tell us whether you pronounce coconut as I do the correct way or coconut. There's no A in coconut.
Tell us if you're going to keep saying Bougainville or if you're going to switch to Bougainville.
Bougainville.
Those are high stakes.
You can hang out with Futurelings, who will surely have opinions about all of this, by just Googling Futureling and follow your nose. It always knows. You can mail us things. Both Ken and I would look smashing in puka shell necklaces. I'm not sure if that is part of Southern Polynesia. Certainly was when I was a kid.
Don't you already have several?
I do, yeah. You can mail stuff to us at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. And most importantly, we entreat you to support our show by going to patreon.com/omnibusproject and joining our legion of fans who contribute to the production of the show, and in return get early ad-free versions of the show 2 days before they're commonly released.
48 hours before the surfs.
And many, many other content benefits that you'll find over there on Patreon.
Listeners, from our vantage point here in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. Maybe it became an ecotopia with bamboo hydro.
Yeah, let's hope.
We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.